And welcome to Truth Quest with Melody and on KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And I've got another fine guest lined up this evening. His name is Madison Rupert. But in the meantime, I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And while I'm at it, I also want to say that the programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. And while I'm at it, I could use anybody that would like to volunteer to be some web help for me. I haven't had a lot of luck in the past when I've asked this, but I certainly could use it because I just want to keep the website up. And sometimes I get kind of a little bit overwhelmed trying to do several programs, and this being just one of them. But in the meantime, I would like to welcome Madison. Hello, Madison.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, and I'm glad to have you. And you have a website that you're the editor of, and it's called inthelie.com, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And would you like to explain a little bit about what your website's about, and we'll get into some of the issues that you've been covering?
Okay, great. Yeah, I started the website, I guess it's approaching 9 months or so ago. It seems like just yesterday. And I just kind of started it up on a whim and really got into it. And I haven't been able to stop researching and writing since I started it. And as you said, we talked previously, you were commenting on the wide range of topics that I look into. And that's, I kind of have ADD when it comes to the things I cover. I'm all over the place. And sometimes I'll get stuck on one topic. I'll focus on one thing. Right now, I'm writing a lot about the National Defense Authorization Act and the situation with Iran and Russia and the military shift towards the Asia-Pacific region. But essentially, the website is just an information database. I have a lot of declassified documents on there, a lot of documentaries presenting a lot of different opinions, and I have my writing up there, the writing of others, and I encourage anyone to send me their writing, and I post a lot of different opinions. I love posting people rebutting my opinions. You know, I'm really a staunch advocate of free speech. I'll readily post an article by someone who disagrees with every single thing that I say, so long as they can back it up. So that's really what the website is about. It's a true alternative news website. You know, it covers the whole gamut of topics.
Well, you know, starting with this National Defense Act, and why don't you go into that? Because this should be a concern for all of us. It didn't seem like we got near the response we should have gotten on the we didn't get near the response we should have gotten on the Patriot Act that it should have brought about. But now that we've gotten this far down the road, it might be important that we really kick it in for this particular legislation. What do you think?
I think that's quite right. I actually said in one of my earliest articles about it when I was covering the version that preceded the S-1867, which was the final version passed by the Senate. It was, at that point, S-1253, and I think it's pretty interesting how I found out about this. Obviously, the mainstream media was completely ignoring it. I mean, I did not hear a single thing from a single news outlet in the weeks and months leading up to these big debates, which were also pretty much not covered by the mainstream media at all. And a user kind of, or a reader, I should say, emailed me in a kind of accusatory fashion, probably rightly so, saying, why aren't you covering this? You know, what are you covering up? Why aren't you covering this? And I emailed them back and I said, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. I was completely ignorant about this. I had no idea that this was even being put forth on the floor. And so I looked into it and started doing some reading into it. read a lot of it. I couldn't read all of it, obviously. It's almost 700 pages with several hundred amendments, you know, ranging from 2 to 100 pages in some cases. So I found the pertinent sections. The reader actually helped me, helped direct me towards those sections, and I was really disturbed. And then on November 15th, they introduced the new version, S-1867, in the Senate. And just worth noting, the House version, the original House version, passed in late May with no fanfare whatsoever. I mean, I didn't hear about it back then. I didn't hear so much as a peep from a single person. So it was pretty clear, like the Patriot Act, these were getting funneled through kind of under the radar with very little discussion, no public debate whatsoever. And what I started out saying was in one of my early articles covering 1253, I said it makes the National Defense Authorization Act makes the Patriot Act look like the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence.
And I really just like the precursor to it, you know, is what you're saying.
Yes, but it actually, I mean, the Patriot Act looks like hunky-dory compared to the National Defense Authorization Act. And I really don't think that's an exaggeration, because the Patriot Act left a lot in the gray area. And that's where the whole secret interpretation of the Patriot Act comes in, which Senator Ron Wyden exposed back in, I believe it was May of last year, which is where they have a completely different version of the Patriot Act, essentially. Of course, it's the same legislation. They just interpret it in a completely different fashion from what you would gather from sitting there and reading it. And so their legal interpretation is very wishy-washy, and it's completely classified. But in the case of the NDAA, it's right there in black and white for you to read, and it's much less ambiguous. And the dangerous thing is that it's explicitly codifying the right to indefinitely detain American citizens without charge or trial on suspicion. And that's the major problem for me, is that it's not they can indefinitely detain you after they've proven you're a terrorist in, you know, it would probably be a kangaroo court, but at least you would have some semblance of justice. No, now all they need to do is have a suspicion that you are a terrorist or have given material support to terrorists or allied groups or anyone who has committed a belligerent act. And a belligerent act is never actually defined. It's just they leave that open to interpretation, like so many other things. So a belligerent act could easily be talking about 9/11. It could be speaking out against the wars. It could be protesting. It could be anything. And all they need is suspicion, and then they throw you away. No one has to examine any evidence. They don't have to present any evidence to anyone, even a closed military tribunal, because there will never be any trial, because you're not charged with anything.
You know, Madison, one of the things that crossed my mind with this is you've got a bunch of lawyers passing this kind of legislation. And to me, what this would purport for them or set up for them is putting themselves out of a job. Because how can they represent somebody if they don't have anything that they can utilize their services for, essentially? I mean, if I can't, I mean, you'd be wasting your time hiring them, from what I can tell.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And actually, if you're detained under this statute, there's no, or this law, I should say, now that it's signed into law, they don't need to let you see a lawyer or a representative or anything. You know, they can hold you incommunicado if they want to. And that's what's really dangerous. And I, a while ago, wrote a pretty detailed, pretty lengthy article covering the Army regulation off the top of my head. I'm away from the house right now, so this is just off the top of my head. I might be wrong. I think it's Army Regulation 190-8, and it covers the status of civilian internee. And I've been saying we would be lucky if we were held under the NDAA as a civilian internee, because it gives you some really, really basic rights. A civilian internee is what the Japanese and German people were held under during World War II. But the unfortunate fact is that in the NDAA, it makes you out to be an enemy combatant, which gives you even less rights, and they don't have to let you have access to a lawyer because they're not actually charging you with anything. So essentially, you're quite right. There would be no need for lawyers, and there's a lot of people who I think don't realize the implications of this. Essentially, all Congress people and senators could be snatched up by the military and said if they say they're belligerent for some reason. You know, there's no restrictions here.
But they can't think they're special then. I mean, because it really doesn't separate them out, right?
Yes, I think they're just hoping that, we're playing along. So, it's kind of like the Gestapo, they're hoping they'll get a little bit extra rations when it comes down to it because they played along with the powers that be. But unfortunately, the reality is that, no, there's nothing protecting them. There's nothing protecting anyone. And the amendments that were put forth that tried to explicitly give American citizens protect the right of due process of American citizens under the NDAA, they were struck down. And one of the last hopes is an amendment introduced after the fact by Representative Jeff Landry, who's a representative of Louisiana, I believe. He introduced an amendment that, again, off the top of my head, I think it's called the Due Process Guarantee Act. But the problem is that it was introduced after the fact. I mean, he voted for the NDAA. It's already in law. The president signed it. I mean, it's over. You know, they can say, okay, we'll look at these amendments and stuff after the fact, but they don't have to. You know, it's already passed. So I think it's just him kind of trying to cover his bases so he, doesn't get branded a traitor, which is what every single person who voted for this legislation is. I mean, okay. in no uncertain terms whatsoever.
Well, ultimately, Gitmo was kind of the predecessor to what this is like, only it was done to another population. So, and look how long they've kept some of those people in there. And then it slides into these resettlements that, I mean, wait a minute, but let me back up here. There's another aspect that they're trying to pass, right? I believe pass right now that's involved with this. If you are accused of it, you could lose your citizenship. Is that, am I stating this correctly? Are you familiar with it?
Yes, it's called the Enemy Expatriation Act. I haven't actually written about that yet. I've read about it, but I need to research it more before I can really write a solid article about it. I think, because, I'm not a lawyer, so, I'm learning this, I'm just throwing myself in the deep end and trying to grasp this.
I think that's how we all do it.
Yeah. But the Enemy Expatriation Act, I think, is actually getting a little bit of an undue amount of attention, because under the National Defense Authorization Act, under the Detainee Matters, subsection D, which contains these detainee provisions that we've been talking about, it actually says that they can hand you over to any foreign country or any foreign entity whatsoever. So essentially, it wouldn't matter if they stripped you of their citizenship. I mean, if you're getting sent off to some CIA torture site in Lithuania, never to be heard from again, does it really matter if you're a citizen? I don't think so. I think what they're doing now is just piling it on.
Right.
They're trying to remove every little last bit of hope that there is at this point.
Right. Somebody brought up today, or not today, but it was in the last few days, is the fact that, even though it's like you said, they can ship you anywhere, but if they did, his comment was, where do they ship you to? What country would, want to take somebody that doesn't have any, the citizenship? So, you don't have a home country if you don't have this country. So,
yes, very true. And I think it's the Enemy Expatriation Act is a symbolic thing. So,
uh-huh.
They could say under that act before they assassinate, say, Anwar al-Awlaki, you know, that they supposedly bombed him in Yemen and killed him. He was the guy who ate lunch at the Pentagon with top brass in 2001. This is while he was on several terrorist watch lists and all this stuff, and they reportedly said that he was the Pentagon was impressed by his presentation. So I'm skeptical of that. You know, he's really dead because of his connections to government. But regardless, they could say, well, he's no longer a citizen, so we didn't assassinate an American citizen. It was just some guy who used to be an American citizen. But of course, under the NDAA, they can just kick down your door, snatch you out in the middle of the night, never to be heard from again, and no one can know the wiser. You know, as far as everyone knows, you just disappeared into thin air. They have no responsibility to tell anyone. So I think all of these things are just codifying it more and more and more so they can essentially do whatever they want with absolutely no fear of having a legitimate legal challenge to their claimed authority.
Okay, I'm going to state that I'm speaking with Madison Rupert, of who's got a website called inthelie.com, and you know, for being relatively new at it, you're covering a wide area of territory of information, and I will, you know, this is the stuff that's out there, you know, for people to find and research, and you've just kind of brought it together in your own little internet. What do you call it? Internet blog.
My little quarter of the internet, I like to call it.
Okay, and so one of the things another aspect that might be a kind of an offshoot of this is the, and I ran across this as myself, is something called a resettlement specialist.
Oh, yeah.
And I was watching a video on the internet on this, and I mean, it was pretty spooky, because what it looked like they were taking our ex-military and kind of just, you know, bringing them in and making them doing to us what we, you know, they did to the Japanese and other minorities during World War II or other conflicts, right?
Yes, and it's very interesting you bring that up. All of these things connect. I think we're seeing all of these seemingly unconnected things, like, you know, the Patriot Act, what we call FEMA camps, you know, all this kind of stuff. They're all connecting now and culminating into a picture that isn't very pretty. And the internment specialist thing, it was actually, I got emailed again by a reader. The internet is incredible for that reason. I have random people making me aware of, you know, a lot of things that I otherwise probably wouldn't be aware of, so I'm very grateful for that. That's one thing I'm very grateful about the internet for. But the ad was on the official Army website, and it was for, the official title was for an internment / resettlement specialist. And they use the typical Orwellian language, you know, couching it in these kind of buzzwords. But essentially, it admitted that they'd be dealing with civilian internees and, you know, dealing with these so-called residential centers, which most people call FEMA camps. And interestingly, on either the same day or the day after the S-1867, which was the final version of the National Defense Authorization Act passed by the Senate, the same day that was put on the floor, which is November 15th, either that day or the next day, KBR put out this request for information from subcontractors across the country in every state to set up these, what they called, National Quick Response Team. And what that is it's a group of subcontractors covering medical to laundry to food to sanitation, I mean everything. They want to have these teams ready to go, so on 72 hours notice they can go from just sending out a call to, in 72 hours, these camps are manned and ready to go.
Now let me ask you something. From what I understand, with FEMA would probably be managing this, right? Or would this be another military entity, or who is supposed to be in charge of these response teams?
Well, I think in the case of the National Quick Response Teams, it is actually KBR.
Okay.
Kellogg Brown and Root, they used to be a subsidiary of Halliburton. I was actually corrected on that. They're no longer a subsidiary.
Uh-huh.
They were contracted in 2006 to build the camps originally. And so I think they are still under contract to man the camps. So what they're doing is just essentially outsourcing the project. So when they get the call from, say, the Department of Homeland Security, which is over FEMA, you know, they're the parent agency, or FEMA or the military or whoever it may be, they can just get these things operational immediately. But as far as who's actually in charge of the camps, I believe under the NDAA, it would be the military, because it gives the military that power. Now, it could be FEMA, it could be, the larger branch of the Department of Homeland Security, but I think it would be military, because most of these so-called residential centers, or, you know, they have all these different buzzwords for them, you know, disaster recovery centers, all of these kinds of things, first responder headquarters, you know. I believe it would be military, because the original executive order that allowed for military installations to be converted to these camps, obviously they're on military installations, so I think it would still be under military jurisdiction. And the whole civilian internee status is a designation that the military gives people. So chances are, I'm thinking it would be the military, like the military mans Guantanamo Bay right now.
So, but when you look back, there's been this incremental progression, and it's been over a period of years that this has all been kind of being put into place, and yet, you know, periodically when we've had these events when they've utilized maybe some of these camps, there's been a lot of problems with the situations to where, boy, they look like they should be ready to go and be a wonderful thing, but all I've heard nothing but complaints about how these things really operate. It's like a fool's a circus. I mean, it doesn't seem to gel as what they're purported to be. It's as though they're gatekeeping, like they're going to do something, but they make sure they fail. Are you following what I'm saying?
Yes, and I think it's just, when it comes down to it, the incompetence of most people in government. You know, I think there are some very intelligent, if you want to use that term, but I prefer, you know, Machiavellian, at the upper levels. But when you get down to the administrative levels and the people who are actually working at these camps and stuff like that, they're not the brightest, bulbs.
Right, but you know, you see guys that are the significant people that are in charge of these things. They seem as though they don't, you know, they don't get demoted, they don't get punished for this. So it appears that they're accomplishing what they were set out to do. And even though they will say that they're trying to go in and take care of Katrina or some of these other disasters, it seems to be the opposite. I mean, what many of us might fire somebody over, you see them, you know, getting promoted and going on to other jobs.
Well, you're quite right, and that's a major problem with our government right now. It's almost impossible to get fired from a government job. I mean, you pretty much have to be on camera holding a gun to someone's head and threatening to kill them to get fired nowadays. So, you know, when they see these horrible jobs that FEMA did in the case of Katrina, or, you know, giving out these FEMA trailers that had, what was it, like asbestos or something in them, you know, they had these toxic chemicals in them, or maybe it's radon,
right,
or something.
I interviewed someone about that, and that's the best way to get fired from a job, is be a whistleblower.
Oh yeah, that's the best way to get fired. It's probably easier to get fired for telling the truth about government malfeasance than it is from, you know, holding a gun to someone's head in the workplace. Probably more likely to get fired blowing the whistle. But I think you're quite right. And the thing is I think it ultimately they just don't care. They could not care less. Once they get the money out, once the contractors get the money, they really don't care about the job they're doing, you know. And all the nature of a lot of these contracts are cost plus contracts. You know, they're no bid cost plus contracts. And what that means is, well, no bid means they're guaranteed. So they just hand these multi-million dollar, sometimes multi-billion dollar contracts over to defense contractors. Without any need for, you know, creating an estimate or competitively bidding with other companies, you know, to get the lowest price. So they can just, gouge us when it comes down to it. You know, we pay the bill at the end of the day. And cost plus means they actually take the overall cost of the project and add a percentage of that cost, to be paid on top of, reimbursing the defense contractor for the cost. So that encourages frivolous spending on the part of the defense contractor. So what they're going to do is spend as much money as possible, and, you know, that's where the whole $500 hammers or whatever, you know, just ridiculous government spending comes from, is because they're actually encouraged to spend as much as possible and do the worst job possible so they can just keep spending and keep spending and keep spending. So if they do a good job, say, you know, setting up a camp for a disaster, you know, that's actually going to be used for legitimate, good reasons, they have no incentive to make it work well because they won't get paid to do the project again. So if they do it and it's a massive failure, then they can say, oh, well, we got to, you know, give them these $300 million contracts to figure a way out a way to do it better. And I think that's the whole cancerous nature of our government, and, you know, the whole corporatism and crony capitalism, is that it just encourages failure.
Yeah, but I can't imagine those at the top really expecting anything but what appears to be failure. I mean, because it wouldn't be acceptable, and everything is corporatized in this country, and even though there appears to be some sort of say by the people, but it's starting to look as though, even with the current election that's going on, I really question, you know, whether we're going to get any kind of a reasonable election out of it, because they've never bothered to fix the voting process, you know, and all they've done is centralize it. I don't know what else we could say about this subject other than I wanted to go with this was the fact that there was a lot of people that did really react to this particular legislation. And have you followed any of the gun rights people and what may have come about from, you know, a knee-jerk reaction to this type of legislation?
Well, the closest group that I've been following in terms of a reaction to this legislation is the Oath Keepers out of Montana, and they actually launched a campaign to recall the two senators who voted for it. They're quite lucky, actually, Stuart Rhodes, and I'm blanking on the other guy's name who leads Oath Keepers. They're very lucky because very few states actually have a law that allows a public referendum to be held to recall representatives at the federal level. And I think that is really what we have to do. I mean, we have to make it clear that this is not okay. And the easiest way to do that is actually at the local level. But I'm not sure if I'm familiar with the guns rights activists that you're talking about.
Not any of the organizations. I'm talking about maybe the people on a personal level, you know, and or militia type that realize that this is, you know, I mean, some view it as a declaration of war on the citizens. Now, I don't know. I'm, you know, all I'm just saying is that I've heard various comments. And I mean, this is the kind of thing that was taking place back when this country was formed, and that kind of led to the Declaration of Independence, right?
Yes, and I think if it continues down this road, there is going to be some very, very dark scenarios that we really don't want to see unfold, some very ugly, ugly things. And I wish that didn't have to happen. What I really hope is that the military, I mean, they're human beings, you know, when it comes down to it. And yes, they get desensitized in training, but they use tactics to desensitize the enemy by making them different. You know, they call them Hajis and, you know, all these things. They invent special names for them and, you know, demonize them, make them look subhuman so the soldiers feel okay treating them as something less than human and killing them on a whim. But I think it would be much harder for those troops to come home and then patrol American streets and shoot American people and lock up American people indefinitely. You know, I think a lot of people in the military would struggle doing that. At least I hope that's the case. I hope they haven't been so brainwashed that they would happily walk next door and drag out their neighbor and throw them in a jail cell never to be heard from again.
Well, one of the
when it comes down to it, mm-hmm. the military could actually stop this. I mean, the military could go and actually indefinitely detain all of the senators and congresspeople who voted for this. And anyone. I mean, you know, they could actually reverse what this has done, but, you know, I don't think that's necessarily going to happen. It might be a little misguided to put all of your hope in that, but it's one of the things that it's a variable that we have to think about, because when it comes down to it, I mean, I don't know of a militia group or any group that could outgun the U.S. military when it comes down to it.
I'm not sure that's what they would be doing anyways. I think it's more or less people wanting to protect themselves in their homes, and that's what it would somewhat come down to. I mean, if they can just come and knock down the door and come take, you know, you and your family out and not have any, and you disappear, or any member of the family, and they disappear and they don't have to answer for it. That's kind of what the reaction that I was hearing from people. But
Well, and they're very right to feel that way, I think, because that's what our country was built upon, not having that, not having to fear a soldier kicking down your door and occupying your home. You know, that's like the most basic thing that America was built on. And that very well could happen under the NDAA. But what I find scary is the precedent set by the militarization of police. You know, they carry out these no-knock warrants where they just come in and, you know, maybe they'll yell police as they kick down your door, or not at all in many cases. They just kick down your door and come in guns blazing. And, you know, one case was a Iraq veteran. He was a military vet, a family man. He had two kids and a wife, and they were carrying out a warrant related to drugs, which he, in fact, had absolutely no involvement with whatsoever. And they came in, and it was a no-knock warrant, so they came kicking down his door, and he reaches for his weapon, which was, in fact, unloaded because he thinks, you know, someone's carrying out a home invasion right now. I need to protect my family. And they literally liquefied him. I mean, they unloaded like 50 rounds or something like that into this guy's chest. I mean, they absolutely eliminated him. And I think that is the dangerous precedent, is that trying to do the most basic instinct, which is protect your loved ones, you know, that can get you just liquefied for so much as reaching for something nowadays. But like I said, I just hope the military wouldn't be crazy enough to kick down a door, you know, with their guns drawn and, you know, just shoot someone.
But see, this is what they've been, But see, this is what they've been trained to do when they've been overseas. I mean, it's nothing new to them. But, you know, of course, they're being put in another situation. But now to talk about what's going on here, that the precedent that's being set up, if you've viewed any of the videos of that have been taking place along the border and the amount of people coming across the border at one time, have you viewed any of those videos that have had, like, bales of drugs on their back walking across? Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
No, I haven't, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, I had the opportunity to interview somebody that is involved in the medical arena of dealing with helping some of these people that are coming across, because, I mean, they're also subjected to some pretty extreme conditions. But the first thing that crossed my mind is, the drugs have been coming across the borders, and they're leaving the borders open, and the hands are tied by the people down there supposedly trying to protect the border. But in the meantime, it's as though the drugs were a secondary effect, because when you saw the amount of people in these cameras that were placed along the border there coming across, if that was going on night and day, that's thousands of people. And you wonder, well, what if they were sending insurgents in? And so you have to wonder, when you start talking to people in and around the subject, it's a lot to be concerned about, because, you know, what is the difference between them coming across our border than coming across the borders down in, say, Central America when they were dealing with what was going on in their countries? I mean, one country protecting another group. And so there's a whole lot of things that to look at. But this, you know, you see things like that, and you see where the civilians here are being, their hands are being tied by the ability to think they can protect themselves, or they can't even protect themselves from their own government when they don't even have the legal right to get a lawyer to, you know, defend themselves. Right?
Yeah, I think actually the open border example is the number one piece of evidence you can point to that shows our government really has absolutely no interest in national security,
right,
or whatever they want to call it. I mean, it's a joke. Come on. If Al-Qaeda really wanted to come over and blow stuff up, you know, they wouldn't get a passport. They wouldn't try and get on a plane, you know, whatever. They could just, walk right over the border. I mean, it's that easy. So it's really, I just scoff when people say, oh, the government's trying to protect us. Oh, you know, all this stuff, it's for your own good. You know, they're not going to use the National Defense Authorization Act against you. It's just the terrorists and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, well, they could take these really minor steps to actually increase national security, but it's obvious they have absolutely no interest in doing that. I mean, when they get, I think a great example is the underwear bomber. His father called multiple U.S. agencies saying, my son is in Yemen. He's being radicalized. I think he's, you know, a part of Al-Qaeda. I think they're training him to commit a terrorist act. And, of course, it was completely ignored. You know, he begged them, please put him on a no-fly list or a terrorist watch list or something. Completely ignored it. And then, you know, he's ushered onto a plane by a guy who flashes a government badge, you know, gets on the plane all drugged up, tries to light his underwear on fire, and then bam, now we have to get molested in airports. You know, it's clear when people actually try and help and, you know, keep people safe, they really have no interest in doing that. And I think it goes back to the fact that all of these things are made to fail. I mean, you can just look at last year when someone got onto a plane accidentally with a bunch of box cutters, the weapons supposedly used to hijack the planes on 9/11. Like, okay, great, wow, all those body scanners and molestation at the airports and, you know, all this stuff, oh, that's really working out. Someone can literally walk through with box cutters or even a gun. Someone walked through with a loaded gun in their bag. I mean, it's like, it's an absolute joke. There is no national security. If there was really a terrorist threat, let's put it this way. If there was really a terrorist threat against the United States, they could be carrying out terrorist attacks left and right. You know, that's what it comes down to. I mean, how many, to say the logic, you know, okay, well, they need to pat us down at football games because it's a soft target and, you know, they're going to blow that up. Well, how come they don't do it? How come it's never happened? It's because the real terrorists out there are inevitably linked to governments. They're linked to intelligence agencies because they're the real people who benefit from this stuff. I mean, terrorist groups don't. What benefit does some terrorist group in Pakistan have from blowing up other Pakistanis, you know? Just really doesn't make sense when you start applying logic to these things. And that's why they have to have the NDAA with suspicion of terrorism, because they don't have to prove that anything. They can just grab you because they don't like you, you know? They don't like the sweater you're wearing that day. Bam, you're a terrorist. I mean, it's really almost farcical. I would laugh if it wasn't true. You know, it seems like an over-the-top movie plot, really.
Well, when you start looking into some of these events that did have accomplished destruction, often there's been drills involved with these events. In and around it, they get sometimes the information gets buried, but it appears that often that it has been a case so that they were able to hide in plain sight while it took place, because if it never made any sense on the NORAD being, you know, called stood down during, you know, 9/11. It, you know, I could see maybe somebody pulling off the first plane into the towers, so to speak, but any of the others, it just doesn't. It didn't stand to reason with the kind of defense system that we supposedly have in place. But
yeah, especially when you look at the flight paths and how they're so erratic and wildly off course and stuff. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever. And what you're saying about the drills is incredibly accurate. You can look at so many examples. One of the more recent ones was actually, and this is not just the United States. If you start looking at these terrorist events across the world, you'll start seeing that they coincide with drills. A disturbing amount of them coincide with drills, which often are carrying out an exercise which mimics the exact same thing as the terrorist attack. And that is one of the things about the drills on 9/11. You know, Bush, there's a clip of Bush saying, well, we never expected this. You know, I don't think anyone in government ever thought someone could hijack a plane and fly it into a building where the National Reconnaissance Office already had whole scenarios written out about how that would happen, and someone would hijack a plane and fly it into the World Trade Center. So, I mean, all of these things have been mapped out by governments, and one of the most recent examples abroad is actually Anders Behring Breivik, who is the shooter out at Utoya Island who killed a bunch of people. There were drills being held that day in Oslo for a bombing, which, you know, he supposedly bombed a site and then drove over to the island and shot a bunch of people. But, you know, there's always questionable aspects of this stuff that's just marginalized. Like, in that case, the Breivik shooting, there were reports, multiple reports, from witnesses on the island saying there were two shooters. You know, distinctly, there were two shooters. And then suddenly, you know, those reports kind of just fizzle out and dry up, and they're never heard from again, and it's just him. And that's like 9/11, you know. No one ever talks about, well, why are Muslim fundamentalists who are so fanatical that they will give up their own life to, you know, bring down this evil free nation, why are they at a strip club getting drunk and doing cocaine? You know, what fundamentalist person in any religion does that? I mean, it just makes no sense at all. And when you start talking about these things with someone who believes the official story 100%, they'll just say, you're a conspiracy theorist, I don't want to talk about it, you're crazy, you know, blah, blah, blah. What I do is I don't actually present a theory. I don't know for sure who was behind 9/11, you know, who gave the orders and all this kind of stuff. I don't pretend to know. I don't know exactly the physics of everything. You know, I don't pretend to know. What I know is that I know the official story has a lot of holes in it. And I know that there has to be an independent investigation in order for those holes to be filled. And it's really easy to discount people when they start saying, when the real conspiracy theories come in, like, you know, oh, it was the Pope who ordered it, or, you know, reptilians, or blah, blah, blah. I think it's a lot easier to get people to start thinking and start questioning these things if you just point out, well, why are Muslim fundamentalists doing cocaine and going to strip clubs right before they martyr themselves? You know, why is, or how is someone able to fly a maneuver that most professional pilots, commercial pilots, can't replicate after taking a couple flight lessons when they couldn't even properly fly a single-engine Cessna? I mean, how are these things possible? You know, what are the chances of that person going perfectly level with the ground and slamming into the budget office of the Pentagon and removing all of the records of the $2.3 trillion that Rumsfeld announced missing the day before? You know, and you start putting together these questions, and, you know, it gets to the point where people are either, okay, obviously something's fishy is going on here, they come to that conclusion, or you're crazy and everything you said is just, you know, whatever, I'm not going to pay attention to it. And it's the same with the NDAA. Either you look at this stuff and say, okay, wait a second, maybe our government has, you know, or our so-called government has gone insane and they are declaring war on the American people, or I'm just going to ignore these passages. You know, I'm going to read them, I'm going to see that it says they can hold you indefinitely, and, you know, it does not prevent it for American citizens, and okay, I accept that and I just ignore it. It's not going to be used for ill, you know. Just like the Patriot Act is not used in the majority of drug cases in less than 20 terrorism cases, you know, they just ignore facts, and that's what you have to do. Okay. To be scared of terrorism, you really have to ignore facts. If you're scared of a terrorist blowing you up, you should also be scared of walking into your bathroom because you might slip and fall. You should also be scared of getting in a car because chances are you're going to get killed in a car accident, much more likely than getting blown up by a terrorist. Or killed by a terrorist in any terrorist event whatsoever. Same with food allergies, accidentally suffocating in your bed, slipping in the shower. I mean, it gets really absurd when you start getting into some of the things that you're more likely to die from than a terrorist attack. I mean, getting kicked in the head by a donkey. I mean, there are so many that with the idea of the war on terror becomes such a farce that it's, I mean, it just makes no sense. You just have to reject reality and replace it with...
Well, one of the things that I think you're, you know, even though you're relatively new at it, you've covered a, you know, a wide swath of information and gotten come up to speed, and I don't know how long you were gathering this kind of information before you started this In the Lie website. How long have you been, had you been involved in working with this kind of information or following this?
Well, I'd say I started first getting into it when I was around 11 or 12 years old, actually.
Wow.
And, you know, I felt...
I don't know many 11 or 12-year-olds paying that much attention, but, you know, that's good.
Yeah. Well, it actually, interestingly enough, it came from my musical taste, really. I started listening to Rage Against the Machine, and I was wondering, you know, what are they talking about? And so I started doing research into these things, and it's kind of just a natural progression to, you know, start looking through these issues. And I've talked about this previously on a couple other radio shows, but I was incredibly lucky. My 11th grade year in high school, my honors U.S. history teacher decided to spend half of the year, the semester, investigating 9/11. I mean, that's really what we did, and we, you know, it wasn't here we're going to investigate 9/11 and everyone has to believe the official story. It's we're going to investigate 9/11, and we're going to have a debate where one side defends the official story and one side tries to debunk the official story. And at the end of the year, we had to have these formal debates, you know, presenting evidence about 9/11, and not a single person presenting the official story won. Because, I mean, you can just sit there and say, you can rebut anyone. They can go down the official story all day long, and then you say, okay, how does a passport fly out of an exploding plane, you know, burning so hot that it can melt steel, supposedly, of course, and fly down, you know, what is it, like tens of stories, possibly hundreds of stories, land blocks away, completely intact for the FBI to find. I mean, it just makes literally no sense whatsoever. And there are these certain key facts that you can present that no one can explain. You know, you just go, okay, well, it was a magical passport. Okay, well, you know, they were magical planes that somehow brought down the building when no, you know, steel building has ever been brought down by structural fire. Or, you know, Building 7, the terrorists just, you know, did their magical terrorist wink at the building and it came down or something. You know, you just got to get more and more absurd in order to explain these things.
Well, you know,
but I was just very lucky going to a school that would even consider looking into these things. And in my senior year, one teacher actually, and it's pretty interesting because it's a, I would say, a hyper liberal school, an extremely liberal school. But one of my teachers in a law and society class, we actually watched an Alex Jones documentary in school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I was in a pretty unique situation in that I got an early start, and I actually wasn't discouraged in my education to look into this stuff, but actually encouraged to do so.
And so did you find anybody, you know, in your age group having that, showing that same kind of interest?
Unfortunately, no. Most people just did it, and then, you know, the second they're out of the classroom, they couldn't care less about this kind of stuff. And, you know, I've honestly, in my age group, I've been somewhat disillusioned. Most people don't even want to hear about this stuff. They don't want to talk about it. They consider the second you start talking about this stuff, oh, it's depressing. Oh, I don't want to think about that. Oh, I have enough stuff on my mind already, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, well, your everyday problems pale in comparison to this. You know, I could be living out of my car and I'd still say my problems pale in comparison to the government being able to snatch and grab anyone and hold them indefinitely, completely legally, you know, with just whenever they want, anywhere they want, take you anywhere they want. I mean, I think that's more important than people's everyday petty problems.
Well, you know, Madison,
unless you're quadriplegic, then you probably have something you can complain about.
So you're saying you've been at this how long then, if since you started so young? Because you don't sound like you're, you know, are you in your 20s?
Yes, I'm in my 20s. I'd say about 10 years or so.
Okay. All right. So, which, you know, that's still plenty of time to, you know, accumulate a pretty good background in education and what's going on in the world out there. But you know what seems to be coming out of a lot of the research that I'm looking at it these days, and this is just one major aspect of it, and then you can, but when you start following this thread, you can find it in so many areas, is that ultimately somebody considers us their slave, and or we do not have any rights. We do not have the right to own anything. We don't have the right to do anything if somebody else decides they don't want us to.
You're very right, and I think that's, when it comes down to it, that's the most basic aspect of all of this. All of this stuff that's going on is the whole idea that you can be better than someone. You have more rights than someone. You can control someone. And I think it goes all the way back into, you know, the earliest recorded history that we have where, you know, there's a priest class and royals and then everyone else. And that's kind of how it is nowadays, except, you know, they don't go around calling themselves the Brahmin, you know, or, you know, whatever title they might have, shaman, you know. People revere these kinds of priest class people, monks, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But you have to remember, they, in the old days, they were the elite. You know, they were the rulers. They told you what to do, what you couldn't do. You know, oh, you're going to hell. Oh, you're going to heaven, you know. All these kinds of things. And a great example is a culture that's, for some reason, romanticized in the United States when it really shouldn't be, but it's pre-1950s Tibet, when the lamas actually ruled Tibet. It was an ugly place. I mean, they really did some really, really horrific things that, I mean, if you just even try to imagine it, it's horrible. It's something out of a horror movie. I mean, you know, gouging out people's eyes, removing genitalia with, you know, unsharpened equipment, you know, I mean, just horrific stuff, as bad as you can get. But since they were the priest class, it was okay. You know, they're on a higher level than you, so they get to decide what they do with you. And it's the same nowadays, except in most circles, it's money that puts you into this higher status. And even in religion, organized religion now, a lot of it is about money. I mean, the Catholic Church especially is absurdly rich. You know, they can pretty much buy anything that they want. They could lift so many people out of poverty, but it's having the monetary control that puts people into this modern kind of priest class.
Okay, I'm going to say I'm speaking with Madison Rupert, who has the website inthelie.com, and he covers a broad plethora of subjects on this site, and I'm sure they will expand as he continues on with this, because he's relatively new at this website. But, you know, it doesn't take long before you, once you start digging and looking for information, to find yourself going off in many different directions. And again, I want to state this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And this is Truth Quest with Melody. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And now, I mean, we've gone off in this particular direction, but there's some other areas that I kind of wanted to hit on a little bit on. What have you been following with the Fukushima event?
Well, I was following it very closely originally. And I quickly realized that most of the information I was getting was completely wrong, you know, especially from the mainstream media. You know, it would change in half an hour. You know, the story would change completely. Okay, this is stable. Oh, no, wait, it blew up. You know, I mean, it would just change so consistently. And what, I mean, I'm on the West Coast. I'm in Los Angeles, so I'm getting bathed in this radiation. And, you know, I know that it was a horrible disaster, and the Earth is essentially blanketed in radiation now, and it will be for a very long time. And from what I've been following recently, I haven't been following it really as closely as I should, but from what I can tell, it's only getting worse. And I think that's really scary, because it's kind of been pushed out of the popular consciousness. You know, Fukushima, oh, that was months ago, that was over. You know, and that it's really easy to do that with a lot of things. You know, they just push it out of the news cycle. So I really haven't been keeping up on it as much as I should, because I've been spending so much time researching the NDAA and all these other things. But, you know, I know I do whatever I can to try and protect myself against the radiation. But there's only so much that you can do nowadays, you know. Especially out here on the West Coast, where
this is the kind of thing when you have to just step back and look at the situation and realize, okay, if this isn't our own government, you know, it's as though we're being under attack from every aspect and angle, and yet, you know, we still look around and we say, well, I'm still standing here, and why? Because I realize, you know, the economy could go into the, and is, according to those at the top, you know, going to blow up and create a new economy or whatever they have in mind, because I've heard so many different aspects of this, other than the fact that, you know, the money is going to be, of the people's, is going to be taken, and somebody's going to end up with it, because it doesn't disappear. Unfortunately,
yeah.
Even though it is made up. that's the irony behind it. But this money doesn't disappear. And so if it's taken out of our accounts, it's taken out of our savings, it's taken from via our debt, and in a very, when you follow the debt cycle that's taking place, and then you follow the all the other aspects of health conditions, and Fukushima plays right in there in a major way, and yet you get to the point as though we're like frogs being boiled in water, and we're not paying a whole lot of attention, because at some point, you know, when do we succumb? I don't know.
Yeah, a lot of people are sitting in the boiling water saying, oh, this is a really nice jacuzzi we're in right now. I think that's the state that the world is in. And like you said, it's not just one government. It's not our government. It's really a global system. And the thing is that the people who truly hold the real power, they don't have any national affinity. You know, they couldn't care less about Americans or Japanese or anyone. You know, everyone is a consumer at the global level. And I really start getting disillusioned, you know, about this kind of stuff when I'm looking into geopolitics. You see so much hypocrisy. It's absolutely absurd. Okay, a great example is the United States and NATO and the West in general is trying to, it looks like they're trying to encircle China and Russia and isolate them, and Iran, and especially China in the Asia-Pacific region, you know, which is what Obama's new military plan, you know, he admits they're focusing on the Asia-Pacific region, and I've been writing about that a lot, is that the NATO shift towards the East. But then you look and look at India. Okay, India is a new big partner in that region for the United States. And we're sitting by idly watching Australia and India develop this nuclear relationship where Australia is going to be sending natural uranium to India to be enriched and used in, you know, God knows what, weapons programs, reactors, who knows? I mean, no one knows. They have no monitoring whatsoever because they're a non-signatory of the non-proliferation treaty. So, we're sitting here talking about Iran all day long. Oh, my God, they're going to develop nuclear weapons and kill us all, while India is, for a fact, we know they are doing that, and we sit by idly. And meanwhile, India and Russia are dealing directly with Iran in their own currencies for oil and not using the U.S. dollar. So it's really they turn a blind eye to certain things. You know, they'll say, oh, we're against Iran, we're against, you know, this axis of evil, you know, whatever they want to call it. But then they allow allies or supposed allies to, you know, do essentially whatever they want. So it's complete hypocrisy. There really is no absolutist position when it comes to governments around the world. It's totally pragmatic. They're constantly shifting alliances, constantly shifting rhetoric and their positions to, you know, whatever the flavor of the month is, you know, essentially. And it gets really disturbing when you start looking at this at a more global level and you see the continuity between all of these governments in the directions they're heading. You know, it's not only the United States that is coming under this kind of overt police state. The UK is horrible in that regard. I mean, in London, you're filmed constantly, 24/7, and they actually can talk to you through some of the cameras, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And they all have facial recognition technology, of course, and they have open citizen spying programs where people are proud to rat out their neighbor for not sorting their trash, you know, all these kinds of things. It's really a global phenomenon.
And it will be coming to a neighborhood near you. I mean, when
you start
seeing these things take place around the world, you hear about them because they want you to hear about them. Because if they don't want you to hear about them, you don't hear about them. So you want to get into not hearing about certain things, go in to start asking questions around the black projects and space program projects that they don't want you to hear about. you know, you might. So this is just, it goes across the board. When you really start asking questions, trying to find the legitimate, I mean, there are lots of legitimate journalists out there, but those that make a living off of it, that's another matter.
Yeah, and you also have to question, you know, I do this constantly. I find myself, you know, why am I getting this information? Why is this out there? Why do I even have access to this? You have to wonder about some things. And I think it's very true recently. There's been kind of an opening up of these things that used to be conspiracy theories into the mainstream media. A great example is the Bilderberg takeover of Europe. You know, with Mario Monti and what's his name, Lucas Papadimos. Is that the guy in Greece?
I'm not as familiar with this aspect, but
well, essentially, they replaced two governments with so-called technocrats. They were Goldman Sachs, Bilderberg, trilateral people. Okay, and this is not. You know, this is something that people would be talking about if this was 5 years ago, and they would say, you're a crazy conspiracy theorist, except in Reuters, they were doing a profile of, I believe it was Mario Monti, the guy's running Italy now, talking about how he's a member of the Bilderberg Group, how he's a member of the Trilateral Commission, all of these things, but it's completely out in the open. You know, before they would say, the Bilderberg Group doesn't exist, or if they did acknowledge it, it would be a tea party, you know, of rich folks sitting around and just, you know, having a laugh. And the same with the Trilateral Commission. But slowly, you know, these mainstream, completely controlled media outlets are starting to address these kinds of things and spin it so it's a good thing. But it just makes me wonder, why now? Why is this coming out in the public now? Why is Ron Paul, for instance, allowed to even talk in the debate? You know, if they really wanted to, they could say, Ron Paul, you can't come to a single debate. You know, they could do that. So it just makes me wonder, why is this opposition coming out now and being allowed to emerge?
You know what? My theory is he's being able to, because he's been able to kind of, you know, put the, what do I want to say, bring the issues to the table. And what I think's happening, particularly while it's early on, is they'll let him bring the issues to the table, and when they want to shut him down, they will, and they'll just take his issues, and they're finding out what the people respond to, is what I'm saying. And if when the people respond to certain things, then they'll just steal his issues. I mean, they do it from each other all the time.
Oh, yeah. Obama's doing a great job of that right now, you know, doing the faux populist stuff, you know, talking about all this greed in our country and all these big bad financial institutions and all this stuff, and it's like, okay, yeah, buddy, just look at where your donations come from. We all know you're completely BSing us. And I think you're right. They're probing to see the things that, you know, people care about, and then they'll just hijack those topics and, of course, you know, never actually carry them out. You know, it's like all of Obama's campaign promises, they're all empty. But I'm just wondering why on a larger level these kinds of systems, which were completely ignored for so long, are coming out in the mainstream media and being allowed to be brought to the forefront. I mean, not too long ago, Bloomberg wrote an extensive article about the Fed, you know, their so-called emergency lending programs. It was $16 trillion. I mean, why is a mainstream publication, a corporate-owned publication that I'm sure, you know, in a roundabout way benefits from the Federal Reserve, like they all do, you know, with zero-interest loans and all these kinds of things, why are they allowing this to be printed, you know? It just makes me wonder, like, why I believe it was a blogger for, it might have been Reuters, I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I wrote an article about it called something like, it turns out that the Goldman Sachs conspiracy or government Sachs conspiracy theorists were right all along. And it was an article about how, in fact, you know, the quote unquote conspiracy theories about the incredibly tight relationship with Goldman Sachs and the U.S. government, specifically the Treasury Department, People would talk about that and, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. Now it's accepted. Okay, yeah, they do these things. Okay, yeah, there's congressional insider trading. Okay, yeah, there's massive mortgage fraud on a national scale. You know, 60 Minutes did a piece about that. I'm just so confused. I really don't have an answer for this. That's why I'm saying why. You know, I'd love to know why this stuff is coming out now. It seems far too coordinated and on such a large scale in the international media, in the U.S. media, on every single topic. It just makes me wonder, why is this allowed to happen now, of all times?
I'm not too sure that it hasn't been happening all along in a certain respect, because one of the things that I used to hear often repeated on the alternative media that it wasn't being stated in the media. And as a general rule, I would say that's probably true. But if you knew how to read the newspaper, you knew the places to glean the information, even in the mainstream, there was a person could keep up if they had a good grasp on what was going on out there. I was surprised, but I had talked to people that didn't have access to the internet and other alternative radio media or whatever, and they understood what was going on if they really knew how to read and look for the information.
Yeah, I think that's just a special breed of person, a true critical thinker that can read the mainstream news and not be taken by the spin. You know, they can look at the facts and ignore the conclusions that they want you to draw and instead draw their own conclusions, which likely are much more accurate. But I think you're very right, actually. I try and say this to people all the time who say, you know, oh, this is a conspiracy theory. Oh, there's no evidence for this. Oh, why don't they cover this in the news? You know, well, they do. It's just it's usually not front page news. Or if it is, it's buried in the you know, third to last paragraph or something, you know, these parts that people normally don't read. And then that's where all the important facts will be thrown in there. So if you do know how to read the news, then you can glean this kind of information. But the problem is the controlled curation of the news. I think a great example is Google News, which I think is a great resource for searching certain topics to find international news sources. That's what I use it for primarily. But if you open up the homepage of Google News, you know, it'll be these top stories. And chances are the top stories are the most irrelevant, pointless fluff that there is that happened during that day. You know, it'll be some stupid thing about the presidential primary, you know, some just really things that don't matter, celebrity gossip, all this kind of stuff. But if you start digging deeper, you can find the stuff that really, really does matter. But it's always buried, and it's not, you know, the first 5 minutes on the 10 o'clock news or whatever. And I think that is what we really have to pay attention to, is the fact that they're catering this kind of stuff for the modern generation of people, especially my age, who only want to read a headline and maybe 100 words. If it's longer than that, well, it's too long. Obviously, it doesn't matter if they couldn't sum it up in 100 words. You know, they only want to listen to the first few minutes of the news because they assume that's the only important thing. They don't want to go out and do research for themselves. You know, oh, if it was so important, someone would tell me about it. You know, it's this kind of relying on other people to spoon-feed you the information that allows this kind of stuff to still fly under the radar somehow, even though it's right there in your face, you know. And I also think there's a psychological aspect to it of cognitive dissonance,
right,
where these ideas are so conflicting with the ideas that we hold about government is good, you know, they want to protect the people, we have representatives who represent us, we have a say in the government, we live in a democracy, we have a justice system, all this kind of stuff. You can't reconcile that with the NDAA or the Patriot Act or Guantanamo Bay or the domestic spying programs or the use of drones in the United States. You know, the list goes on and on and on. So they just ignore it. It goes back to that thing, you know, either you accept it and start having to look into these things for yourself and really think freely, or you just shut off and say, you know, I'm going to go get a Bud Light and watch a football game.
Yeah, okay. So you've been at this about 10 years. I mean, because I've been trying my darndest to try to get an interest in the younger kids to even get involved with the radio and whatever. And I know there's one here or there, but the whole idea and thought to try to get them involved in, even adults involved in this, because it isn't just that, okay, you don't have to take on the world like you have in a sense. All you have to do is take on it in a local aspect, because what I'm finding is it all ties in together. It just depends upon where do you want to jump in the river at, you know.
Yes,
and then when you're in the middle, and then when you're in the middle of the river, you got to choose a side, which side to go, and it's really coming down. And I don't know if you're at this point or not, but it's come down to, it is kind of a spiritual warfare, whether you, or a decision of, you know, what is right and what is against your gut. What made you decide, you know, I mean, because obviously you had to decide that, you know, things weren't right. Something's not correct here, and I need to do something about it, right?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing, I think people can get really easily discouraged when they get into this kind of stuff, you know, excuse me, thinking, what can one person do? You know, how can I take down this global system? Well, the great thing is that you don't have to. If you set out trying to do that, you're just going to be disappointed, because no one person can do that. But if you go out and make one person think critically and start looking into this stuff for themselves, I think you've won. You know, if I only had one person reading my website, and, you know, I helped them look into new topics, and then they started talking to their friend, and their friend started talking to their friend, I would consider my site a 100% success. You know, that's all I want to do. But what really made me get into this is I really do think it's a gut instinct. There is really a moral line that gets crossed when you start saying, okay, I can't just sit idly by and watch this happen anymore. You know, I'm not sure. I don't necessarily identify with any organized religion, because I've found out in my life I'm usually wrong. You know, if I'm completely convinced that I'm absolutely right about something, I'm probably wrong about it. So, you know, what I do is I know a few things. I know that
you're giving yourself too much credit on the probably wrong part, though.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just know it's not right to kill someone. It's not right to hurt someone. You know, there are these very basic right and wrong things that get far too often put into the area of pragmatic morality. You know, well, it's not right to kill someone except if, you know, this. It's not right to hurt someone except if this. And I think the only exception to that is if you are about to get killed or mortally injured, then you have to defend yourself. But you don't necessarily have to kill someone. I don't think that's always justified by any means. But I think our society nowadays is getting moved further and further away from these absolutes. And it doesn't necessarily, people go, you know, oh, well, that's religious, so that's dogmatic. And no, it's not, because, you know, I'm not saying that the Bible tells me I shouldn't kill people. I'm saying you shouldn't kill people. You know, I just know that. You know, that's just something that I know to be true. And you don't need any religion necessarily to tell you that, although I think, you know, the Bible is in a lot of ways an incredible text. I don't necessarily think that you have to believe everything in the Bible to know that killing someone is wrong, or the Torah, or the Quran, or, you know, whatever it may be. I think there are these conclusions that everyone can come to if they really just look deeply inside themselves and say, you know, am I okay knowing that my neighbor could be dragged off in the middle of the night and locked in a cage like an animal and left there to suffer for eternity? I mean, does that sound okay to anyone? I'd really like to, you know, some people actually say, you know, oh, well, that's okay. They're a terrorist, you know, all this kind of stuff. And you have to really, you have to push them to start thinking about where's the line? Where do you
Right.
draw the line? And I draw the line a lot earlier than I think most people do. And it's because one negative aspect of my education is they really talked a lot about relative morality and pragmatic morality and stuff like that about, you know, well, nothing is really right or wrong. You know, it's the culture that you're in. It's the time, blah, 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 blah. And I don't think that's correct. You know, I don't think there's any time or any culture where raping someone is okay. You know, and if there is a time in a culture where they find that acceptable, I say, well, they're wrong, essentially. You know, I just don't find any justification for these kinds of acts. And I think it's going to take more people. You know, you can call it spiritual warfare, but I think it's psychological warfare. I think it's keeping yourself from being able to be taken in by these kinds of things where they say bombing civilians is okay if there might be a terrorist there. You know, all these kinds of things where they give you these caveats.
Okay, when I'm talking about spiritual warfare, I'm not necessarily getting into any religious aspects. I mean, there's a, you know, it's like you're saying, there's a right and a wrong, and something that is wrong, the best terminology I can think of is evil. So, you know, and if you follow your innermost gut, you know, you're telling me, and I feel the same way, that you know we have a moral compass if we listen to it. And it doesn't have to come from... Go ahead.
I think we're being trained to not listen to that.
Right. Oh, no, we've been trained from the beginning not to. So it's trying to relearn that and reconnect with that we don't have to be told by certain groups or sects or whatever it is to that, you know, what's right and wrong. We automatically know. Our human psyche knows. And so it's time for us to reconnect. And there are those that, you know, having a hard time, particularly when we're being led by economy or numerous other aspects that we get exposed to that influence our choices as to what we do about it, right?
Yes, and I think it really takes sitting down with just yourself, you know, turning off the TV, turning off the radio, turning off your computer, and just sitting there and thinking for a second, you know, where am I going to draw the line? Where am I going to say enough is enough and I need to start doing something? Even if it's just talking to your family and saying, you know, well, what do you guys think about this? You know, maybe we should start trying to eat healthier, or, you know, maybe we should start trying to be more active in our community, whatever it may be. You just need to listen to your gut when it comes down to it, because I think if you stop looking to the outside for answers, you'll start finding that you can find a lot of the answers from within. And right. I think that's one of the, actually, to go back to religion for a moment, one of the most often ignored things in the Bible is one of Jesus' main messages was look in yourself. You know, seek and ye shall find. You don't necessarily have to... You don't have to seek out a priest to tell you what to think. You can look into your heart of hearts and just sit there and think about it, and, you know, call it meditation, call it whatever you will, but you can just figure out, and you just know that some things are wrong. And I think when people start getting back to that, we'll start seeing some major change.
Well, you know,
and a lot of people, I think that's what post-traumatic stress disorder is people get trained out of listening to their heart and stuff,
mm-hmm,
and then
right.
post-traumatic stress disorder comes after the fact, where, you know, they're having these huge moral dilemmas, you know, having nightmares every night about killing that person, you know, in Ramallah or whatever, because we're not supposed to be doing these things.
Right, cognitive dissonance that kind of starts taking over there, and people don't know what to do. You know, how to react. You know, I want to get back to this Fukushima thing a little bit, if we can. You've done several articles on it. And one of the things, you know, I mean, I hear total opposing things on the fence on this. But there's some things here that, again, this is where looking at... one of the things that I've followed and realized in my life is, you know, if something doesn't seem right, keep looking. Because often you're going to find out things to back up that that gut feeling. And I'm hearing that, Japan may be toast, or Tokyo, and yet it's going to affect the whole world. And we can live and be exposed to radiation. I think they've found that out during all the testing that they did in this country for years, and people still lived. I'm sure there were plenty of people that didn't from this sort of thing. But you have this accident taking place, and yet one of the things that you're pointing out is, it opened up talk of a lot of the incidents that have taken place over here that we don't even hear about, right?
Very much so, yeah. There's a lot of things that just get glossed over, and I think if you look now at the mainstream media coverage of Fukushima, you'll be very surprised at how little they're covering it, and it's because it's been pushed out of the news cycle. And they don't want you to keep thinking about that this never stopped pumping out radiation. It never stopped pumping out these extremely dangerous isotopes that can travel all the way across the world and have a half-life of, millions of years. And that stuff isn't going anywhere. And they want people to think, okay, that's just Japan. I don't live in Japan. What do I care? But we're, it's kind of cliche and silly sounding to say we're all connected, but we really are. You can't isolate anything in the world, and I think we're finding that out more and more and more. And I'm a big fan of chaos theory for that reason, because it says projects like HARP say if they're manipulating the weather in one certain region of the world, it's not going to just affect that one region. It's going to affect the entire world. And when you pump radiation into our environment, it's not just going to affect one tiny little isolated sliver of the world. It's going to go into the water, it's going to go into the fish, it's going to go into the flora in the ocean. I don't think that we'll start seeing the true effects of Fukushima until a great deal of time passes, and then we'll start seeing really abnormal incidents of cancer, especially on the West Coast, of birth defects, of all of these kinds of things. And, it'll take a while for it to, pass from, the grass into the cows, into the milk, into, our children, all of these kinds of stuff. It's all slowly building. And it's way too easy to forget these kinds of things, but when you put it all together, it really is cumulative. We have the essentially bio warfare that is genetically modified foods. I mean, I consider that a method of biological warfare, along with exposure to radiation and all these kinds of things. It really is. Compounds. The more that you have, the worse it gets. So we can't think about, there's this tiny dose, relatively small dose of radiation that you're getting every day from Fukushima. But when you combine that with the damage done to your DNA and to your cells by Roundup Ready corn, which is in almost everything, and, electromagnetic pollution, which can actually in some cases, in certain frequencies, it's been shown to actually strip DNA strands.
And then that we can directly attribute to an effort on the part of. I was just listening to a video of a city council out on the West Coast dealing with PG&E, I believe, wanting to what?
The smart meters, right?
Right. And their effects, even there were people that were complaining about, that affecting them health-wise, and they were, the excuses that were given in this thing were almost like, the council people asked some very legitimate questions, and PG&E just had some, some lady up there just, fronting the whole thing and coming up with an, excuses for reasons that they couldn't put back the analog meters, and for health reasons, if I'm recalling that correctly. And it's like they were pointing out, well, if that's for health reasons, then why can't you put the analog back? And yet they're changing out thousands all over in this country, and from what I understand, they're doing it around the world now. And this is this type of exposure, plus the radiation exposure, plus the Roundup exposure, plus the other electromagnetic cell phone exposure. They're all incrementally taking a toll, right?
Yes, very much so. And it's more than just damaging your person, it's damaging future generations by, lowering fertility, making you more likely to have birth defects, all of these kinds of things. It's a long-term solution to, they constantly talk about overpopulation. There's too many people in the world. Well, are there? I mean, no. We could feed the whole world many times over if we weren't so absurdly wasteful. They don't need to pack a supermarket full of raw meat every single day and end up throwing half of it out at the end of the day. They could take that and go feed people with it, but they don't. And it goes back to the design to fail thing. They don't produce food to actually feed people to make the world a better place. They're just doing it for money, And of course there's a backlash against that with the whole organic food industry. And, local foods and food co-ops and raw food and all this kind of stuff. But you're right. It's all incremental, and it's looking at the long term. People say, well, you're not dead. Why is Fukushima a big deal? Where are all the dead people lying in the middle of the street? And it's like, well, how long is your attention span? Do you really think it's going to show up tomorrow? No, that's not how it works. All these things are, soft kill or slow kill warfare methods. And it's exactly like, a lot of the strategies used in Vietnam were slow kill methods, with Agent Orange especially. We can't go in there and shoot them because they're hiding in these underground tunnels and whatnot. So we're going to kill all of their food and then starve them to death. This kind of strategy is what we're seeing, but obviously on a much longer term scale and on a global level, completely contaminating the food supply beyond all repair, contaminating the air with barium salt and aluminum and all this stuff that we call chemtrails,
and the water
engineering,
and the water
is horrific, especially here in Los Angeles. I mean, it's horrible. They send you out these water reports.
Well, you do know about recycled water, don't you?
yes, I do. And I'd probably actually feel a lot better about what I was drinking if I knew exactly where it came from, even if it was recycled from my urine. At least I know where it went and where it came from. But we're just getting bombarded on so many levels. There's the physical assault that we're under 24/7 on all these things that we're talking about. There's the mental assault 24/7 from the mainstream media and Hollywood and all these types of things. And once you start realizing what's going on, you'll start to see it everywhere. And,
right.
I mean, you start to realize, okay, terrorism isn't a real threat, okay? They really want you to think and be scared of terrorists, so you will give up your
liberty. See, that also, you have to also realize stress is another factor. And if they're trying to slow kill, stress is a good example.
You're incredibly correct. I actually watched a documentary not too long ago called Stress, the Silent Killer, I believe it was called. And I believe it was a National Geographic documentary, but it was just going over how stress really does kill. I mean, it literally degrades your body. So if they can keep you in a state of constant stress, constant fear, constantly looking around for a solution, thinking, you're going to get stabbed at any moment and all this kind of stuff, they can control you, and it can also literally degrade your lifespan and also your quality of life.
Okay, now you take you take those same people that are stressed and you put them in a smart growth, highly congested area among all the people telling you what you can and can't do, and you don't have any sovereignty of ability to make up your own mind and live your own life, because you've got to take into consideration what the consensus is, then you have another kind of stress that has been thrown in there. And it isn't just about the good of the people. What does that do to the psyche of the human?
That's a very good point. And I think one aspect of that we should pay attention to is institutionalizing people. You know, I used to study psychology before I got into this stuff more heavily when I started my site. People can get institutionalized, and that doesn't mean just, locked up for their entire lives. It means it's actually a psychological mindset that you get in where you can't do anything unless someone tells you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You literally can't get up and go eat unless someone says, okay, now it's dinner time, go sit over there and eat this. And I think it's on a larger scale happening in our country, where you can't have an opinion unless someone tells you that's an okay opinion to have. A lot of people talk about the welfare state, and I think it's not just trying to make people dependent on government. I think it's actually trying to, on a large scale, institutionalize or make people go into an institutionalized mindset on a national level. So it gets to the point where people, there's so much uncertainty in this world. A lot of people don't know where their next meal is going to come from. They don't know if they're going to see tomorrow. And if an institution, be it the government or whatever, say a global government, comes out and says, okay, we can give you all the solutions. Just listen to us. We're going to feed you every day. We're going to give you a bed. We're going to give you entertainment, all of these kinds of stuff. There are many people who would say, wow, that sounds great. Sign me up. Everything's guaranteed. You're going to tell me what to do. Whatever. I don't have to worry about anything. That sounds great. So I think they can create these really stressful situations, and it's the classic problem-reaction-solution thing that so many of us talk about is, they create this problem of uncertainty in the world, be stressed all the time, fearful for your safety, all these kinds of things, and then they offer what, obviously you have the reaction of fear and stress and, concern and all these kinds of things, and then they offer the solution. And we can see that in the case of disasters, everyone's freaking out, what do I do, because they aren't prepared, and then FEMA comes along and says, okay, come into these camps, we'll feed you, we'll wash your clothes, we'll give you the medical care that you need, all of these kinds of things. So I think on a larger scale, it really is creating a problem for which they can offer the solution at some point in the future. And it remains to be seen when that will be or what it will be.
Well, interestingly enough, I'd done an interview. Oh, I'm trying to think of the person that I interviewed at this point, but that there's several different talk show hosts have been talking about the trivium and quadrivium. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, very much. That's really how I operate. That's how I analyze news.
Well, guess what? Not a lot of educated people even know what that is. And yet, you want to explain it to the public?
Well, essentially, it's just going back to what the classical education is supposed to be. A liberal arts education originally, now it's like a liberal arts degree is pretty much a joke. Like, what you learn with a liberal arts degree? Not much. But it used to be, you would get this education really on how to think. And it's a larger thing than just teaching someone. It's like, the old adage of, give a man a fish and, he can eat for a night, or teach a man to fish and, he can eat forever. You can either teach someone these rote memorization tasks and, facts and all this kind of stuff, or you can teach them how to think in a critical way and analyze things and use logic and all this kind of stuff to better understand everything. And I think that is really important. And I try and do that in my articles. I don't think I do it often enough, honestly. I say, you know, don't take my word for it. I'm just one person. This is what I think. You know, this is a conclusion that I've come to. Consume this information and then think critically, think logically, and come to your own conclusion. And I think the biggest part of the trivium and the quadrivium is logic. And it's so lacking in modern society that it once you learn all the logical fallacies, and there are so many of them, you'll be overwhelmed when you start looking through them. You'll find them everywhere. And I mean everywhere. You'll be listening to so-called experts, you know, on TV or on the radio or whatever, and you'll hear logical fallacies left and right. And I'm sure I'm guilty of many logical fallacies just because we're conditioned to think illogically. And it goes back to the cognitive dissonance thing. You can't have two dissonant ideas and reconcile them logically. You can't have government is good, they're protecting us, and government is waging war on us and considers all of us enemies who can be detained indefinitely. You can't logically look at those two things and say, okay, they can coexist. So what we've been trained to do is stop thinking logically, stop analyzing for ourselves. The most oft-used logical fallacy is the appeal to authority. It says, you know, okay, well, this is right because this person has A and B credentials, and they are right just by the fact that they have these credentials. They're a so-called expert. They're an authority on the matter. So just listen to them. Don't think about it. Don't look into it yourself. The end. And that is so often done. The appeal to authority we see all the time with government. They say, okay, we know this and this to be true. Say, you know, okay, we know Al-Qaeda is planning an attack on the United States. And, you know, most people don't say, okay, well, where's the proof? Are you going to explain that anymore? Or are we just, you know, supposed to believe this? You're not going to show us any evidence. They just say, well, we're government. We're telling you this is true. We wouldn't lie to you. You know, who, me? You know, that typical thing.
Beware.
So, yeah. So I think if you just start encouraging people on a all the time, I mean, challenge people's ideas. I mean, I love to play devil's advocate in any conversation. I will talk to someone that I agree with 100%, and just so we can keep talking and, you know, come to some better conclusions or think about some things in a new way, I will pretend that I disagree with them, you know, and just challenge their opinions. And I love when people do that with me. That's why I love for people who disagree with me to email me. I was having a long, extended email conversation with one guy who actually runs this website, which I find pretty humorous. It's called Skeptical Humanities, and he's a professor at Georgia Tech, I believe it is. And basically he does every week, he does this like this week in conspiracy theories, and he finds the most absurd conspiracy theories and derides them. And a lot of them are really legitimate, but he comes at it from such an absurdist angle that, you know, it seems like a joke. But
and that's where your trivium and quadrivium come in. I mean, that, you know, being able
exactly
to think. Right. And where would somebody find out these logical fallacies? Who would have a good site to look at this kind of information on what this is about and why it's so important?
Well, actually, a great resource for the logical fallacies specifically, one that I've found, is actually Wikipedia. You know,
okay.
a couple years ago, I would say steer clear of Wikipedia all the time, but now pretty much you get called out if you say anything that is unsourced. So you got to look at, you know, a claim made on Wikipedia, and if there isn't a citation and you can't track down the citation, ignore it, is what I say. But they actually have a really good page that's just a bunch of logical fallacies, and you can click on them and look into them in more detail and search them online, because a lot of the logical fallacies are kind of hard to wrap your mind around at first, because we've been taught to think in these ways, to employ these logical fallacies so often that you're saying, wait, this is wrong? I'm not supposed to think like this? Like, what? I don't understand. So you really have to challenge everything that you know to be true, especially if you received a public school education. Basically, you're taught to think in logical fallacies. You're taught not to think. You're taught to memorize, and, you know, that's it. And we see that a lot in higher education. By that I mean postgraduate level stuff, doctorates and whatnot. In a lot of cases, it's just you memorize the information and spew it back. You don't think about it. That's how, you know, so many things, especially like with vaccines and all these kinds of things, people can say, well, how can doctors allow this kind of thing to happen, you know? How can they allow the pharmaceutical industry to be so cancerous and making people sick so they can offer them the drugs to, you know, make them better, which just make them sick with something else so they can offer something else? And it's because, well, they've been taught not to think about these kinds of things. You know, they've been taught to just regurgitate information. And we need to get away from that as much as possible. You know, learn all the facts, but come to your own conclusion. Don't let someone else tell you what to think. And I find myself guilty of kind of, you know, giving my opinion and saying, you know, this is right and this is wrong and blah, blah, blah. And I need to make a conscious effort constantly to move away from that, to not call people sheeple or the masses or anything like that, because you're falling into the same trap of, I'm better than you, or I know more than you, or I'm smarter than you, you know, all these kinds of things that separate people artificially. And they create these boundaries that really shouldn't exist, you know. There aren't any sheeple. There are people who are just ignorant and misled. And I don't consider ignorant to be a negative thing. Many people do, but I consider myself ignorant on very many topics. And it allows me to consume a vast amount of information and try to come to my own conclusion, but not have it set in stone. You know, and I don't have any other than some really basic things based on, you know, natural law, don't kill people, don't hurt people, all these kinds of things. Other than that, most of what I know is it's not completely concrete, because I know information could come along that challenges it completely.
I think all our ideas and truths are being challenged, and it's us to see that we learn to think along the lines that you're talking about, because stepping outside the box and expanding our horizons and looking at the information and the data and being able to go back and reanalyze it and say, well, maybe I shouldn't have thought that way, or let's look at this again, or something along that line, and not feel that we, you know, oh, I've decided it's this way and this is the way it is. Right.
Yeah, and we also have to learn not to be offended. If someone thinks something completely different than I do, I'm not offended. I embrace that opportunity to learn something new and hopefully, you know, open their mind to some possibilities that they haven't thought about before. You know, you really have to. It's so easy. I find myself doing this all the time to get frustrated with people. You know, be like, well, you don't know about this, you know, blah, 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 and you just get angry. I have to step back and say, wait a second. You know, I was like this at one point. Everyone was like this at one point. You can't know everything. So you really have to embrace differences of opinion, differences of interpretations of certain things. You know, I think we've really lost the human-to-human interaction of talking about these things, challenging each other's opinions. You know, instead of sitting around at a table with your friends and talking about, you know, the football game or the baseball game, which most people do nowadays, we used to sit around and talk about, okay, well, why do you think we're here on Earth? You know, well, what do you think is controlling everything? You know, well, what do you think the purpose is of this existence, you know? And I think we've lost that. We've lost the looking to each other and going into small groups and discussing these things and challenging each other. And I think if we get back to that, we'll start making some huge steps forward just to challenge each other and challenge our beliefs and our preconceived notions.
Do you find that you're getting much response of people your age that come to your site? Are you getting a lot of people in your age bracket?
Not as much as I would like, honestly. you know, it's kind of like, I'd say, you know, I'm on Facebook. I'm guilty. I realized, you know, long before I got into this stuff, I was on Facebook and all this stuff, and, you know, now I realize, well, okay, they already own all of my information and all my pictures and all this kind of stuff. There's really no point in disabling my account now. I might as well use that platform as a kind of a tool to get information out as much as I can. but they actually have been known to shut down accounts for talking about political topics and stuff like that. But, you know, most of my friends honestly couldn't care less. They have no reaction to any of the things that I talk about. You know, there are a few that do, but I think it's not nearly enough. And actually, it's pretty encouraging. There's a younger segment actually involved with Oracle, you know, Oracle Broadcasting, which you're on, I believe, right?
Right.
Bob Tuskin and the people at the Intel Hub, you know, they're closer to my age. So I think there is a new wave of people getting into this kind of stuff. But more often than not, I'd say the people who contact me and the people who I come in contact with are much older than I am, you know, twice my age or more, I'd say. But I think it'll get to a point where people can't ignore it anymore. You know, if they're actually kicking down doors and dragging people out of their homes, kicking and screaming, never to be heard from again, how can you ignore that, you know?
Well, you know, until they start seeing it, you know, I'm trying to think, was it Alexander Solzhenitsyn? I'm saying his name right.
Solzhenitsyn?
We're talking about how, you know, they wish they would have done something about it when they had the ability to do something about it, because and this is that point in history, people. This is now. This isn't down the road. This is here and now. When you've got your president signing this kind of legislation, it flies in the face of all our founding documents. And whether they could prove it with, you know, legal, legitimate, lawful, you name it, arguments, it goes against human nature to state that we want to be imprisoned in somebody's ownness. And this is what they were rising up against, is the having to fall subservient to a monarch. And this is coming around again, because they never gave it up. You think they were ever going to give this kind of idea up if they didn't have to? They've come back around again, right?
Yeah, they just want to repackage it. That's all it is, rebranding it. And like you said, you're very right. We're at a turning point in history, and you know, you're not going to be able to research this kind of stuff if you're sitting as a civilian internee or an enemy prisoner of war in some camp somewhere, or you know, something to that effect, or you know, if the Stop Online Piracy Act passes and the Protect IP Act passes, you know, you might not be able to research this stuff online anymore or very easily.
This is a unique time in history. We've never had access to the kind of information that's out there. Granted, everything is, books have misinformation. It isn't just, you know, the internet. You have to be able to decipher between what's true and isn't true. But that's, again, that's where being able to source your information and not just regurgitate it.
And I also think it's important to never get all your information from one source. I try and steer clear of using one source for my articles, because I'll find it only presents a small sliver of the picture. So I think to get a real accurate idea of what's going on, you might actually have to read 10 sources or more, you know, from around the world, from all these different points of view and different opinions in order to really understand what's going on. And I need to emphasize again, you know, now is the time to stand up and to start talking about these things and researching these things, because, you know, like Solzhenitsyn said, you know, once you're going to know it's too late when it's too late. You know, and then you're going to be like, why didn't I research these things before and start talking about this and standing up? So now is the time. You know, there's nothing stopping you. You should really exercise your right to look into these things and to make your own decisions.
And why should it be illegal to grow your own food? Why should it be illegal to be able to buy dairy products that haven't had that have been cooked to where they're not near the nutrition that they had, or any other aspect in our lives? Everything is being incrementally closed in upon as far as freedoms and things that we've had in the past. Granted, some things have opened up, but I don't know that they're going to stay there that long. So the whole idea of the press and the internet has been a wonderful source. Once it became accessible to me, I've spent as much time as I can trying to glean what I can, because I knew once when I saw it there that it was going to be there for a limited period of time. You know, it may still be out there, but the information will be culled that we want.
Very, very true. And I think that's a very important point to make, because, you know, the internet very well might still be there forever, but the only thing you're going to be able to do is, you know, watch videos of cats and, you know, look up sports scores and stuff like that. It's pretty interesting. If you actually start Googling, you know, you'll find the control of information just in that aspect by seeing what results they serve you. And if you go on a different computer, it'll have a different search history tied to it, and you'll start seeing different results that they serve you. And it's everything. I mean, you know, if you're just looking at pictures of cute cats and sports scores all day long, the results that will come up for you will be a lot less substantial, and there will be a lot less information. Heck, you might look up the NDAA, and it might come up that the National Dog Association of America something. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, it's pretty wild, but that's what is happening.
That's the way Google was designed.
It's an information collection tool and a way to shape the information that you get in a certain way.
I mean, the internet can be used for us and it can be used against us. And those people that understand that also realize that you know, there's a whole lot of things that may come about that might not be where we want it to go, but it will be used against us. Right?
Yeah, well, we have to remember at the most basic level where the internet came from. You know, it's originally called ARPANET because it was developed by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project agency or association or agency, I believe it is. But, you know, the military created the internet. You know, the same groups that now were, you know, researching these really mind-blowing, mind-controlled devices and all of these kinds of things, they created the internet. So you do have to keep that in mind, but you can also, like I said, use these systems like Facebook for your intentions. You know, you don't have to sit on Facebook and just look at your homepage and read people talking about how they just went to Starbucks. You can use it to actually get information out to people. And when you start getting effective at that, that's when Facebook actually steps in. I've seen a couple cases where people have had their accounts shut down or certain websites have been blocked, you know, for infringing on the community terms of service, you know, which include don't say anything that could upset people and all these kinds of things. So it's very interesting. We truly are at a fork in the road right now, and one path is very dark and one path is almost hard to imagine. You know, it could be such radical change that, you know, it's really hard to imagine a world without war profiteering and parasitic usury and corrupt pharmaceutical industries and food industry and all this kind of stuff. But it's possible. You know, there's nothing stopping us from creating that kind of society.
Well, there's one of the other things that I've found that, you know, you can get really depressed over this whole situation and the like. But this is one unique time in history when we can really take a step and become responsible for our thoughts and our actions, and it has its own momentum. And if other people see us doing it, they will start doing it. And so we lead by example. We learn truth by speaking truth. And so it's you know, starting, I mean, I started at it much later in life than you did, but it's so refreshing to see somebody that has taken on the the aspect that you have, because I know doggone well how much work has to be behind this effort that you have just with this one site. Do you have much any help with you doing this?
Well, I started out completely by myself. I have one guy semi-regularly submitting articles, a couple other people sporadically doing it. Nothing major, though. You know, I run the site by myself. I, you know, pay the hosting bill, all that kind of stuff. Thankfully now, you know, I run an ad so I can actually cover my hosting bill. But originally I was running at a loss of, like, you know, $120 or so a month. But, you know, I knew this is bigger than just $120 a month. You know, I could still be losing that and I'd still be happy knowing that people are actually reading this information and thinking about it. And a very encouraging thing is the reaction that I've actually gotten from family, a lot of whom are military people. A lot of people in my family are in the military. We're kind of a military family, I guess, if you want to say. And a lot of them are Republicans. They all live in the South, both sides of my family. So I would never think that they would take it upon themselves to read my website and actually read an article. But they are. And, I mean, it's incredibly surprising. I'm actually having conversations.
People that wouldn't have listened 4 or 5 years ago are starting to realize there's something wrong, and they better start paying attention, because the money that's in those bank accounts is disappearing, and the ability to go get a job and put money in those bank accounts is disappearing. And then when you have the laws being passed and smart meters and all these other things, being your food and your air and your water being poisoned, something needs to be, a light bulb needs to go off here and start figuring out that, what do you do? Do you stick your head in the sand? I don't think so. I mean, it, you've made your decision if you do that. So
yes, exactly. And you can stick your head in the sand. You can live in a state of constant fear and depression over these kinds of things. Or, like you said, you can start taking responsibility for your thoughts and actions. And, you know, I found it extremely empowering when I just started writing about this stuff. You know, if I go back and read my first posts, I'm like, wow, I sound like an idiot, you know, because I've learned so much since then. I would encourage everyone, you might think you're the worst writer ever. You might think that no one cares about what you have to say, but why not go? I mean, that's the beauty of the internet. You can go out and start a blog in 1 minute and, you know, no one might read it for a couple weeks, but then you might start getting people reading it, and it might get popular, and you might, you know, who knows where it can go. So if you just take the reins and start taking control of your reality and your existence, I think you'll be very encouraged.
Right. And, you know, I want to thank you very much, Madison, for an interesting discussion, and it's refreshing to find, you know, this much interest and effort by you. But I run into a lot of people doing this out there, and that really encourages me. I think, you know, I'm the only one, and I'm alone and by myself, and nobody's listening. And even if nobody's listening, then I hear somebody say, "Oh, I've listened," or you know, here and there, and you realize that. I find more and more and more people doing the same thing. There's so many people out there speaking out now. It's amazing.
So. Yeah, I think that is the key. Do not let yourself think you're alone and that, you know, you're the only one thinking about these things and talking about these things. I think if you just start bringing it up in the company of friends, you might find one of your friends has been thinking about these kinds of things for years and they just don't want to talk about it because, you know, they might seem weird.
Right.
So I think if you just put yourself out there, you'll find some really astounding, great things can happen. You know, I've met a lot of incredible people over the past few months, a lot of whom I've just had contact with in emails and stuff like that. But, I mean, it's just amazing the things that can happen if you just stop procrastinating and start taking an active role.
And again, I want to thank you again, and your website is inthelie.com. And Madison, I hope we can do this again.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks a lot. And we'll say good night.